FEMA told people in South Texas they should be prepared to evacuate.
A 100 years from now, if New York is abandoned, I picture some explorer coming to Manhattan saying, those ignorant people, how on earth could they have ever expected to survive?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. This show is a 1-2 punch on extreme climate and peak oil. From the University of Washington, Dr. Peter Ward explains why an all-tropical world isn't such a good vacation spot. In fact, it's poisonous to life as we know it. And with the Arctic melting fast, it could just happen.
Let's say we take a globe that has a nice cold pole, as we do now, at both ends, and warm in the middle. Well, the warm wants to go to the cold, and the cold to the warm, and hence we have beautiful winds and currents and ocean currents. The whole circulation system is based on this world that is warm at one point and cool somewhere else. If we warm the whole thing relatively, there's no more driving force for currents, and no more driving force for big air currents or ocean currents. Things stagnate, and when they stagnate, oxygen goes away.
Peter Ward is author of many books, including his latest, Under a Green Sky. We'll also talk about his upcoming specials on the Animal Planet TV show called Animal Armageddon. Then in our second half hour, Julian Darley looks at the energy solutions like relocalization and energy farms. Julian is the founder of the Post-Carbon Institute, an author and public speaker coming to us from Sebastopol, California. You want ideas to solve the energy mess? And Julian Darley lays it out later in this program. We start with Peter Ward, explorer and paleontologist, talking about times when the climate here on Earth shifted beyond human imagination. From the University of Washington in Seattle, a warm welcome to Dr. Peter Ward, author of Under a Green Sky. Hello, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
Well, of course, you know, we all want to know how the sky could be green, but that story does take a little bit of introduction. Could we start with your summer field trip? Can you tell us what that was about?
Well, I was lucky enough to get to go to Australia, down under, way up north and down under, so one of the hottest parts. We're looking at very ancient rocks, Devonian-aged rocks, and interestingly enough, the same aged rocks that makes up much of the front ranges in Alberta, where we Americans get a lot of natural gas, and you Canadians too, is from the Alberta province and ancient coral reefs. So we're looking at similarly aged coral reefs of Devonian age. There was a big mass extinction among them, and we're trying to figure out why is it that about 360 million years ago, over half the species on Earth rather suddenly died out. Both Canada, Australia, every place in the globe experienced this big biotic crisis. So that was really the impetus to send us down under.
Well, that's something we certainly need to know about. I mean, is it even conceivably possible that we could have another mass extinction like that?
Yeah, that's the interesting question, all right. And certainly in America right now, we're having the political season, and there's charges back and forth and forth and back, and it's very hard to get a rational point of view. But it looks like there's a really strong chance, possibility at least, that we may elect someone who has a vice president who neither believes in global warming nor in evolution. So here we have it, someone, a heartbeat for the presidency or could be president, who believes that there is no such thing as global warming in any way, shape, or form, and secondly, that evolution doesn't work. So some big designer in the sky did everything. What a combination, huh?
Yeah, that's politics, but underlying politics, too, we also have the public knowledge, and I think that the public needs to hear the kind of work that you're doing, and I wanted to give you this chance, if you would, to outline some of the process of these past extinctions and how we can study them at all.
Well, interestingly, we're really in a brand new era. It's very exciting. We have developed, not we, I wish I could say I was part of it, but my colleagues around the world in many disciplines have developed powerful new methods of understanding past biology. The way we paleontologists, and I'm a old-style paleontologist, I'm proud to say, trained in Canada, got my PhD at McMaster by Toronto and Hamilton. The way I learned it is that we went out, found a fossil, and made our interpretations. But now there's a whole new generation that goes out and takes the rock that my fossil may have come from, extracts the organic oils that are present in so many of these rocks, and then analyzes the compounds within these beautiful golden little droplets of oil that you can squeeze out of these rocks. And within these, there can be interior pieces still preserved of ancient microbes. This generally cell walls are so tough, microbial cell walls are so tough, that we can really glean important information on who are the dominant microbes at any given past. That has led to a great revolution. And one of the things we were doing in Australia and then later in Nevada, and soon I'm, as soon as it gets to be summer ending here, I'm going to head to Antarctica and do the same. We're going to try to understand if we had microbes at the major mass extinctions, which seem to correlate to times of very high heat and low oxygen in the oceans. The oceans themselves can lose their oxygen if we have a globally warmed world. If you think about it, what makes wind? Well, wind is simply air masses that are going from warm places to cold places or cold to warm. Let's say we take a globe that has a nice cold pole, as we do now at both ends, and warm in the middle. Well, the warm wants to go to the cold and the cold to the warm, and hence we have beautiful winds and currents and ocean currents. And the whole circulation system is based on this world that is warm at one point and cool somewhere else. If we warm the whole thing relatively, there's no more driving force for currents and no more driving force for big air currents or ocean currents. Things stagnate, and when they stagnate, oxygen goes away. When oxygen disappears, whole different regimes of microbes can take over the oceans, and they seem to have done this in the past. Well, in the past, it wasn't we humans, of course, that were globing the world, warming the world. It was volcanoes and monstrous volcanic outpourings of a type that haven't happened in actually tens of millions of years. But back then, they did. And very quickly, the world warmed to the point with greenhouse gases that the poles warmed drastically. It turns out through the physics of warming, which I don't understand but I'm told works, is that the tropics can't get much warmer than they are. They're already heated to about the point they can, but the poles obviously can. And I saw the news report this morning of gigantic bits of polar ice breaking loose and cutting loose into Canadian seas up there. So we're really seeing unprecedented change in the ice caps, and it's through global warming.
And then it seems that the ocean somehow could become poisonous, if I understand the theory in your book right. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. One of the microbial groups that does best when there's no oxygen is a form that produces hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is a great poison. It's that rotten egg smell. And the reason that we react so strongly to it and hate it so much is that it is at very small concentrations, parts per million, can kill we humans. I mean, just the tiniest whiff of this stuff, we're so sensitive to it because we know intuitively or deep in ourselves that this is poison. We cannot deal with this stuff. Stay away, stay away. And yet when we have an ocean with no oxygen at its bottom, and worse, there's no oxygen at its top, these microbes take over and they can start producing, if they get enough nutrients, they can start producing enormous amounts of hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is a poison to all animals and plants. So it's not a good thing. And the microbes have produced this hydrogen sulfide have left behind little biomarkers, little bits and pieces of their cell walls in these Australian rocks we looked at. We've gotten the same stuff coming from your nice Canadian rocks of the same age. And in fact, we've now found these about 10 or 13 time intervals in the past, all coinciding with rapid global warming through volcanic events.
Yeah, you know, it's so surprising to me because before I read your book, I think like most people, I thought that the past extinctions, what little I knew of them, were caused by asteroid or comet hits. But now we're finding out just since the year 2000 that it's climate change.
Well, there's still the death of the dinosaurs is still very reliably pinned on a bad asteroid. But so well did the Alvarez group of Berkeley convince the world that this was the method that everybody said, well, gee, if it happened back in the Cretaceous 65 million years ago, well, surely all the other mass extinctions could have plausibly been caused by this. And in spite of very little of evidence that any of the other mass extinctions about impact, because there is reliable evidence of impact, there's bits and pieces of the asteroid, for instance, and country rock that can be thrown up into the space and come back down, bits of the crater and a crater itself. In spite of the absence of really good evidence of this, that any of the other mass extinctions, somehow this since about 1990, this creeping sense that they were all caused by asteroids has taken over science. And it's just now that we're starting to say, well, wait a minute. How about this? How do you correspond these microbial bits and pieces we're finding from these aged rocks with the possibility that we had an asteroid? There's no way an asteroid could stop the oceans from having oxygen. Global warming can. And so this is where we're starting to see one of these scientific revolutions and change as people start realizing, oh, my gosh, you know, if it happened in the past, could it happen again? Is CO2 is CO2? That's the problem. You know, we just because we have it being made by humans, it's still the same molecule. It still has the same physics. It still causes our atmosphere to warm, and it still causes our Arctic to be radically warmed, as we are seeing right now.
Yes, we just lost one of our five ice shelves, I believe, in northern Canada. You know, I was wondering, too, in your book, you credit another scientist, Andrew Knoll, for publishing a vision of how climate might have killed off the species. That was in the late 90s. How does your work build on or differ from his?
Well, Andy and I are long-term, old-time colleagues, and I'm just a huge fan of his work and proponent of what he has done. I don't know a single case where he's ever been wrong about anything. I'm sure his wife would tell me the opposite. But scientifically, you know, he's been gold standard. And what I've tried to do, Andy, in terms of past mass extinctions, concentrated mainly on the Permian. And we've tried to branch out with colleagues, including Canadian colleagues, to look at others of the so-called Big Five. You know, there were five major events during the age of animals, which is the last 500 million years. And one of these was the dinosaur killer. One was the Permian extinction of 250 million years ago, where we are now again finding the presence of these hydrogen sulfide bacteria, one in the Devonian. This is the one we're studying in Western Canada and Australia. One at the end of the Triassic 200 million years ago, where the best site to study it is in British Columbia at Kennecott Point in the Queen Charlotte Islands. And one in the Ordovician, where I just came from, and this is studies we're doing in Nevada, but there are wonderful rocks of this particular age in the Rockies as well. So, yes, it's been an interesting adventure.
Well, one of the problems that I have, and I think my listeners probably have, is how to integrate this shocking, I would say, science into our mental consciousness. I mean, we go out, the streets look the same, the houses look the same, but we know that, well, you could say we're the new volcanoes. We're creating conditions that could drive a climate change that moves faster than we think. How do you deal with it personally? You've got kids, you've got a future invested, so do I. You've got students. How are they dealing with it? How do you integrate this knowledge?
Well, part of it is I try not to get too depressed when it just is clear that if you yell and scream and have the best arguments in the world, there will only ever be limited acceptance when the world has become so politicized. The thing I love about Canada and always have is that the discourse there always seems more reasonable. You know, we are so separated in this red-blue nonsense down here, and it's not just political. It becomes what scientific point of view am I going to accept or not? And there's this still nonsensical debate going on here on whether or not global warming exists, and if it does, could humans have done anything about it when the sources are... Al Gore is correct. I mean, we've moved on, the scientists at least have moved on beyond that we must take into account from a societal point of view that this is a very grave danger. And the way I try to express it, at least to our politicians on the rare chances I get to talk to them, is that, well, look, you know, what if we global warming chicken littles are incorrect and it turns out that we are wrong? There's no way that humans are doing anything. Well, the stuff that we're advocating, moving away from carbon economy, moving away from cars which use too much oil, moving away from very wasteful technology that we throw away in the dumps, moving away from that stuff, even if we're wrong, it's still going to help society. We still need to do that, global warming or no global warming. If we're right and we don't do anything, well, there goes civilization as we know it. Perhaps not in our time, but our children's children will certainly be suffering the onslaught. And the most dangerous onslaught that will soon be occurring, I believe, is sea level rise. I mean, melting all the ice sheets, which is happening now, has a dire effect on the coastlines, a city like Vancouver. What's going to happen to Vancouver if we have a 20-foot rise in sea level, or my own Seattle where I live? I mean, this is quite an amazing thing, that if you take a city, which I've done, of the city of Seattle, and just take a map and take the 20-foot contour, and then say everything below that 20-foot contour is now underwater, well, you've got a very different city. It's a disaster.
Well, and it may weaken us to the point where we don't really have the resources to respond then, whereas now we still have all the machinery and the cement or whatever we need to, I guess we might need to move our cities unless we change our society, as you suggest, and reduce our fossil fuel emissions. Well, this is Radio EcoShock with scientist Peter Ward. His whole field of paleontology has been swept from the back rooms of collecting right into the front pages of the newspapers. Dr. Ward, your book, Under a Green Sky, came out in late 2007, but even though I follow climate affairs, it took me almost 8 months to get the book and get your message. I worry that the slow pace of communicating new science all the way out to the busy public and the politicians, it might be too slow to save us. So what can we do?
Well, my biggest fear, of course, is that we are the converted are speaking to the converted. The book that I wrote, Under Green Sky, sold so horribly that the book company just dropped me. They don't want to deal with this. They said, no, there's no sales here. This is science, and it's just too scary. And the people who do read it are people who are already convinced that, gee, something's got to be done. So the big question is, how do you get to the people who don't read? And in America, I think the figures are so astonishing. I think we have 30 million people out of 300 million who regularly read, what you could call readers, who go out and actively buy books and go to the libraries and keep track of stuff. And so that's a very small percentage, obviously. How do you go to the rest? And the rest is through television. And so what I've been doing, and this may sound awful, but I think it's sort of, maybe it's my last gasp and last hope. I'm the scientific coordinator of a large new series for Animal Planet, which is one of the networks. And we're doing a 8-hour series called Animal Armageddon, not my title. We're going to take these mass extinctions and we're going to populate them with CG, beautiful dinosaurs and all the creatures. And mass extinction by mass extinction, I intend to show that it's not just asteroids, but it is global warming, and that global warming can be produced, as we'll see, by these volcanoes in many ways. And I hope that people who watch television, a light bulb will go on and they'll say, aha, well, wait a minute, if carbon dioxide can do that and cars make carbon dioxide, wait, do you mean? And so I'm just hoping that if we get conversion of one person who doesn't read, who does watch TV, I mean, there's one extra person, right? What else can you do?
I agree. And, well, this actually sounds pretty exciting to me. So that would be Animal Planet. Do you have any idea when it might come out?
I do. It's going to be out early 2009. So January or February, Animal Armageddon. We've populated it with some of my favorite creatures, not just dinosaurs, but Permian mammal-like reptiles. We're going to have Ordovician early fish and Nautiloid cephalopods. We're going to have Devonian early amphibians. We're going to have Triassic early archosaurs. We're going to have mammals. We're going to have a lot of really interesting animals going through, event by event, these various what I call greenhouse extinctions, getting the point across. It's kind of like, I don't care who you are animal-wise, when it gets too warm, the world goes sideways and bad things happen.
Well, I could sort of see a two-level approach to this. You know, one definitely is public education, which I see you working on, and I'm happy to hear that. And the other is to somehow get to our leadership, and hopefully we get better leadership, and get something going. Because, like, the Brookings Institute, for example, just came out with an editorial, an op-ed in the Washington Post, and they said, 7 years to climate midnight. So whoever takes over in 2009, they've got to about 2015 to make real action to stop this flow of carbon and to help the rest of the world do it. or we may run into irreversible climate change, and who knows what could happen then?
Well, we certainly have a clock that's ticking. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The rate at which carbon dioxide is going up now is very regular. Up, up, up it goes. We're at 380 and something, and it's going up about 2 parts per million per year. Everybody that I know of in the climate change industry thinks that 500 is definitely tipping point dangerous, that we really should cap it in the mid-400s if we can, bring it back down if we can. Perhaps we maybe brush 500, but bring it down. But we cannot sustain a world at 500 parts per million. I mean, that already puts us at CO2 levels that are higher than anything in the last 20 million years and maybe way longer. We are going to geologically historic levels. I mean, we're higher than any time in the ice ages. We are really, really going back in time, and back in time means no ice caps. No ice caps or ice sheets means not just a 20-foot sea level rise, but a 240-foot sea level rise, 80 meters. I think that's catastrophe in anybody's point of view. Now, let's say we coordinate that in the next 150, 200 years, and it correlates well with the rise in human population to 8 to 9 to 10, maybe 11 billion people. When sea level rise hits maximum human population, there's nothing but disaster in that recipe. There's not enough food already. Let's say we remove a great proportion of the arable food, and much of the food of the Earth comes from deltas now, and every delta on the planet is going to be gone, not with a 240-foot sea level rise, but a 10-foot sea level rise or less removes every delta. And that's probably about 25% of crops being produced right now. So there's urgency here. There's urgency here.
You've also described in your book Life Under the Sea from your explorations as a professional-grade diver, I guess I would say. And you've expressed a real worry about the sea and its future, and it seems like that's sort of the mother of life, if you want to say. I can't picture it being all fished out and then losing oxygen. We've got the dead zones going. What can we do to help the sea, in your opinion, as far as this climate shift is going?
Well, certainly we need to really think hard about our the way we eat fish and what fish we do eat. The big debate in my state and probably in your maritime provinces is fish farming versus non-fish farming, because clearly, I mean, there's sins to both sides. If you overfish, I mean, that there's a stock that's gone, and that affects everything. On the other hand, some of the fish farming that takes place, salmon farming in Washington State, for instance, by necessity, so much of the food escapes that it produces great balloons of algae on the bottom that then produces these oxygen-free zones. And we've, you know, it's kind of darned if you do and darned if you don't. But what we really need to stop doing is over-harvesting. And that's quite clear that so many of the great stocks, I mean, look at the cod stocks off eastern Canada. My gosh, no one ever thought there could ever be a dent in that resource. And we now know that more and more fishermen fight over a very dwindling and crashing resource. You see fights almost between the Spanish who come out and the Canadians who are there and the Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, this is right in the center of the media center of Canada. It's right in your front doorstep. This is a crash that should be telling us something about not just Canada, but the whole world.
I think a lot of Canadians have taken that one to heart. But I'm thinking, too, about the acidification of the ocean and what's happening with the reefs, the coral reefs. That seems to be climate-related, would you say?
It absolutely is. And it's not just the coral reefs. Well, the coral reefs themselves are under great stress, as we know. And what you're saying is correct. The ocean has been one of our greatest allies in dealing with carbon dioxide. So much CO2 from the atmosphere in excess quantity is absorbed, dissolved into seawater. I mean, the oceans have been this great buffering system that have allowed us to really get away with far more CO2 than should be up there. But nevertheless, we've gotten away with it because the oceans are saying, okay, I'll take some more of that. But there are limits, and the limits have been certainly reached in the Arctic oceans, where we now know that certain of the very low in the food chain mollusks called pteropods are now living in oceans just slightly acid enough that they are having a great trouble producing their calcium carbonate shell. It is, in fact, dissolving off their backs, killing them. The coral reefs are under the same sort of stress. They are calcifying organisms, and the increased acidity from more CO2 has led them, but also the great heat we find in the coral reefs. I have a project now, the Great Barrier Reef, that I've been going to for 3 years, tracking the chambered nautilus, an animal I began studying early in my career, and I'm back to a late in my career. But the Great Barrier Reef and many of the reefs are undergoing what we call bleaching. This is a loss of the symbiotic small algae that corals have within their flesh. If it gets too warm, these jump out. When that happens, the coral can no longer calcify as reliably as it did. And corals are always have been on a balance between growth and the destruction around them of bio-eroding creatures, of waves, of hurricanes, of storms. It's been just a nice balance. Well, that balance is disrupted. So in the Arctic and in the tropics both, excess CO2 has had a very, very dangerous effect on the ecosystems.
Now, in your field of paleontology and as we relate it to extreme climate change, can you tell me what are some of the things that we really don't know that we need to know? What do we have to find out here?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one that I've just been banging my head even the last couple of nights. The best climate source on the web by far is called realclimate.org. I'm not associated with it. I wish I were. This is done by five or six really good independent climate people. It was named, I think, one of the 50 best websites of any website in the world. Realclimate.org looks daily at the climate challenges. And these guys have brought to my attention something that's really scared me from paleontology. Can you have ice sheets, ice caps in a high CO2 world? You know, maybe we can get away with it in the sense that maybe we can get up to higher carbon dioxide. We need to know from the geological past, was there any time in the past when carbon dioxide was 500 parts per million or higher when we still had ice? Is there any way, perhaps, can we learn a trick that tells us, well, we just can't bring CO2 quite down enough, but look, there's still some ice sheets here. Maybe we have a little more time than we thought. And so these sorts of really interesting deep time examples and lessons are showing us a great deal about climate, things that we didn't know, that I think are very germane to the argument today.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you'd really like to tell our listeners, a sort of take-home message, if you will?
Well, I just think that what we need to do is talk to our kids and read to them, turn them into readers. I mean, that's the simplest way, I think, to save the world is produce more readers, because it's going to be the readers that save it or not.
This is Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington in Seattle. He's the author of a revolutionary new book, I think. Well, it's not a new book, but I really like it. I think it's well-written, it's science well-told, and it's necessary information. I'm going to tell my listeners, if you read only one book this fall, this would be it. So maybe the sales haven't been great so far, but they should be. This is a book people need to read. Peter, thanks so much. We really appreciate your time with us today.
And anytime you want me back or anything I can do to help, just call.
That is a very kind offer, and I'll take you up on it. Bye-bye for now. Subscribe to the weekly Radio EcoShock show as a podcast. Just click the podcast button on our homepage at ecoshock.org. A special welcome to all the college students back for a new year listening in via our 15 college and community radio stations. If your local station doesn't carry this important news, will you send them an email asking for our program? Activist listeners like you help deliver what the mainstream leaves out. You can write me anytime with tips, radio@ecoshock.org. We'll be right back with a full-on interview with Julian Darley, founder of the Post Carbon Institute. We'll talk about what the heck we can do about the energy mess we're in now. Come back in just 1 minute after station identification. This is a clip from the song House of Trouble by Clatter.
This is the most serious problem facing humanity in the 21st century. If we don't address it, we'll undermine and perhaps destroy civilization.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
What will life be like after the carbon age? And how will we get there? Julian Darley is the founder of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of the book High Noon for Natural Gas. We'll talk to Julian about relocalization, energy farms, and peak oil. Julian Darley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
Well, there's so many things we could talk about, but I wanted to start with your own peak moment. When did you realize you wanted to work so much on peak oil and gas?
I started something called globalpublicmedia.com in 2001, and that came out of some work that I'd done at the BBC and I suppose about 15 years, 10 to 15 years, making films and videos and other things in the realm of media all the way from London to Hollywood. And particularly what happened was after my master's in journalism in Texas, I focused my attention on the difficulties of trying to explain complex issues, particularly scientific issues, but not only those. Those are a particularly difficult subset. Also environmental issues, issues to do with ecosystem problems, and rather crudely, the sort of collapse of many ecosystems, which has been going on for a long time and is becoming more obvious. These things are actually very difficult for us to understand, even those who study them. And communicating the problems and the scales of the problems and the implications of the problems to a wide public so as to build a constituency that will, in the end, move politicians and business and so forth to understand and do something about these things is a very, very important task. So then, not many months after starting globalpublicmedia.com, which exists to this day with a huge archive now of interviews in audio and video about these matters of the environmental and ecosystem and other problems, I was lucky enough, in fact, through a local bookshop, which has now sadly gone out of business in Vancouver, where we were then living, somebody said, you must read this book. It's actually a book by Jeremy Rifkin. It was about, it's called The Hydrogen Economy, and it was very interesting. I had my doubts about the hydrogen economy, and I've got a lot more now, but the essential reason that he was putting forward why we needed this supposed hydrogen economy was the forthcoming decline of oil. And to me, it was an extraordinary revelation because my second master's had been in social research and the environment, quite strongly focused on many environmental issues. And we'd touched on energy in a rather glancing fashion, even though this master's degree was actually in combination between a sociology department and a chemical engineering department. So there were grounds to think that the science would be handled in quite a rigorous way, and some of it was, but the energy part was sort of glossed over. And when I realized, because of the understanding that this forthcoming oil decline was a reality, and I think there's little doubt about it now, everything fell into place. My goodness, this is the missing link in all the studies that I've done over decades, not having energy at the center and core of things, leads you into a large amount, I think, of problematic thinking. I've studied philosophy in some depth, not in enormous rigor, but in some depth over the years, and it's been quite a lot of time on it. And it's amazing now to look back at it, how much philosophy, in my opinion, goes off the rails because there isn't an understanding of the kind of fundamentals of life. And the first fundamental of life, and perhaps the last fundamental, is energy. So it really does change everything when you put energy at the center of your thinking. And it brings a lot of other things, I think, into the right relative position. And you can understand what to do about some difficult problems a lot more easily. It doesn't make everything easy by any means. But I think it helps one to see that, well, this looks like a good idea on the face of it, and it would solve lots of problems. But when you actually see it from an energetic point of view, you realize, oh, wait a minute, you're assuming a boundless energy, a boundless cheap energy supply. That's a pretty bad idea, especially as our boundless cheap energy supply turns out to be not so boundless and not so cheap.
Yeah, a lot of Americans are finding that out right now the hard way at the pump, and I think there's more pain to come. But you seem to be ahead of the pack in saying, well, all right, this energy is limited. I've come to accept that. Now what? And so you've founded the Post-Carbon Institute. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Post-Carbon Institute was a direct result of the energy revelation, if you like. And essentially what happened was that we had global public media, and we started putting on in early 2003, we started putting on, they were sort of halfway between mini conferences and lectures, if you like, and it just didn't seem quite appropriate that these should be under the auspices of global public media. I should say that global public media was an attempt, however absurd it might sound, an attempt to do a sort of mini BBC on a shoestring because, as I say, I'd studied, done some research for about a year inside one of the most important programs, in my estimation, the BBC, around current affairs. And I've held the BBC, and I do hold the BBC in high esteem and high regard, and I use that as one of the models. And the other model is the Open University, founded in the 1960s in Britain, which is an extraordinary institution, I think it remains so, which gives just about anybody the opportunity to take a degree, to take rigorous, systematic education, even if you, for whatever reason, didn't have access to it in your late adolescence and early 20s, which is the more common time. So thinking of the Open University, we started putting on these lectures, conferences, if you like, but I realized the BBC doesn't put on lectures and conferences. Other people do it, and the BBC filmed it, and it did start to feel odd. So that's why we created Post-Carbon Institute, which avowedly and openly is the vehicle for trying to analyze and disseminate in different ways. I'm thinking also policy communications, and also start working out responses. And that's been the path of the Post-Carbon Institute since then. And I've refined the mission into the barest few words possible, and that is the mission is to get society off fossil fuels fast. I could add on to that in decent, environmentally restorative ways, in socially decent ways, and so forth, without causing collapse, chaos, and so on and so forth. And those are very serious extra parameters. But the central task is to get society off fossil fuels fast. And that is what we try to do night and day, basically. And it's an ironic situation that as the price of oil goes on rising, no great surprise to anybody who accepts the peak oil situation, it both gives us much more opportunities and possibilities to get the job done, but it also is shortening the timeline dramatically because things are happening pretty fast now.
They are really rolling very quickly. Now, I found the Post-Carbon Institute seems like a nexus point for a series of movements, really, and I wanted to start with relocalize.net. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The Relocalization Network, whose website is relocalize.net, formed in a similar way to Post-Carbon Institute. And in other words, it formed out of a need. It's as close as anything to having bubbled up from people just getting together and saying, but what can we do? In my book, High Noon for Natural Gas, published about 4 years ago, the last and by far the longest chapter is, but what else can we do? In other words, what else other than burn loads of hydrocarbons, you know, oil, gas, and coal, fossil fuels? What else can we do? And that had been the question that we had been asking. We, in particular, the executive director of Post-Carbon Institute is Celine Rich, who, by total coincidence, happens to be my wife. And we'd been asking these questions for almost as long as we'd known each other, which is about 10 years now, is a sense of frustration, I think it's fair to say, that fine words were being emitted by people who thought very carefully about issues, but there didn't seem to be enough coherent action across a whole range of different societal actors, citizens and government and business and so forth. So we we wanted to create ways, very practical ways, very strongly based on fact and careful theory and careful analysis, that people, I mean humans and institutions, could take actions quickly and effectively with the greatest possible effect and the least number of unpleasant side effects. So that's kind of what we set out to do.
And I noticed just lately in the UK Telegraph, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard says high energy prices might swing manufacturing back to America since we can't afford to ship all that stuff with oil and the tankers. So there could be a kind of cresting wave of realization about peak oil and the social implications. Are you seeing that?
Yes, as a matter of fact. It's very interesting recently that it would appear that for the first time in many years, some steel products are actually cheaper in the United States of America if they're made in America than if they're made in China. I'm talking about raw steel, as it were, rolled steel and things like that, because the shipping costs are now becoming so high that even without carbon taxes and so forth, which are a difficult area and not necessarily existent, the prices of shipping and transport are now getting so high that it's starting what we've called relocalization, going back to a time when things were made more locally. So yes, in fact, it's already started. And if you think for a minute about the fact that, wait a minute, steel being cheaper to produce in America than producing it in China and sending it back to America, that I think is momentous, and I think we've only just begun to see these effects. One of the things that I think, one of the unfortunate side effects for now, is that manufacturing will be repatriated from the Far East back towards the North American continent, in the case of North America. The trouble is, it's most likely to go back to maquiladoras just south of the Texan and that border there, Arizona, Texas, and so forth, into the north section of Mexico, south of the Rio Grande. And these maquiladoras are very unpleasant places where under very poor working conditions pertain, very poor pay, much pollution, and so forth. But, of course, it's cheap to do that. So that's a bad side effect. It would be much better if goods intended for Canadians were made in Canada, wherever possible. Those for Americans were made in America, preferably as local to where, regionally as well, and the same for Mexico. On the other hand, even if things do go back to unfortunate situations in these maquiladoras, at least it's close. It's not 5,000, 6,000, 8,000 miles away where it would be extremely difficult to police or check or anything else. In other words, if the United States wanted to do something about the maquiladora situation, it's very much easier if you're just a few miles from the border of Texas than if you're thousands of miles away, in a much more cognate language, i.e. Spanish rather than Far Eastern language. So in that sense, it may well be progress, and if people decide that they want to have decent and better working conditions and the whole thing done in a much more reasonable way, then it can be done much more easily. So I think it's important to note that. But in general, it's an inevitable move as oil costs go up and transport costs go up. But it's just a warning to say we could do this thing better and we could do this thing worse. And so one of the things that Post Carbon Institute tries to do is to work out sensible, including economically sensible, pathways so that we can do things better, more regionally, more locally, and not revert to things which are pretty unfortunate for just about everybody except a few who profit at the top.
Well, another aspect of that, too, is localized energy, and you talk about energy farms. What is an energy farm?
Well, as we conceptualize it, an energy farm is a place that tries to be energy net positive, in other words, to export energy. And we see this, one of the special characteristics of an energy farm, the way we conceptualize it, is that energy farm is trying to use as few petroleum inputs as possible. So what you're trying to do is produce as much renewable energy with as few non-renewable inputs as possible. One day we're pretty well going to have to manage like that. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but part of what Post Carbon Institute does is tries to prepare and work out scenarios in which there really won't be any petroleum and really won't be any fossil fuels. It's not going to happen tomorrow. I'm not pretending it is. But, for instance, if you realize that having to manage a society with no petroleum, no fossil fuels, that means no coal at all, was going to take, let's say, 60 years of preparation so that there wasn't absolute chaos and very unfortunate circumstances and so forth, then if you realized, oh, wait a minute, we may be completely out of all fossil fuels by 2100, and it's going to take, well, let's say you worked out that it was going to take 100 years, then you realize that you'd better start doing this in earnest in the year 2000. Well, we didn't. So you see what I mean? If this thing is going to take a long time, and we'd like to be as little pain and done as decently as possible. So this is one of the reasons why I think we need to start modeling some pretty rigorous conditions, and that, I think, will also help us to make the transition faster, because we may make some, I hope, we'll make some very useful discoveries in the process and realize, hey, wait a minute, we can do this with no fossil fuels at all. It wasn't nearly as difficult as we thought. It makes some economic sense. We can do it in an environmentally good fashion, hopefully even restorative fashion. Why don't we do that much sooner rather than later? And if we get going on that research now, or better still, yesterday, then we're much more likely to find those kinds of things soon, and that could be a huge benefit to us, rather than waiting till 20X, whatever we think it might be, and then discovering, oh, crumbs, we should have started this 50 years ago.
And I think another driver of that is the ream of scientists who are coming out now and saying, well, look, we've only got 7 or 8 years at the most to get these big changes underway, or we're going to suffer a lot more fires and floods and rising seas and all that sort of thing. So that's another driver, is just the climate change aspect.
Climate change should be a much bigger driver than it is. What I'm saying is that I think, and I have thought for decades, that climate change is a tremendously powerful driver. When are we actually going to see really serious change? One of the interesting things is you can say, well, actually, U.S. gasoline consumption appears to have peaked in 2005 and appears to be on the decline now. And indeed, the number of miles traveled in America, the total number of miles traveled in the personal vehicle, is actually now declining quite quickly. But it's not because people are worried about climate change, or rather they might be worried about climate change, but that's not what's causing them to change their behavior. It's high gasoline prices, average gasoline price well over $4 now across America, and I think it's about $4.50 here in California. So what's starting to happen is that peak oil and the high and rising prices associated with that, for particularly gasoline but other things, are becoming a kind of de facto climate policy. And what would be really good is if climate and peak communities came together and said, instead of just being driven around by the market, as it were, we should actually get together and start developing policies which take into account both peak and climate. And this is something that we're still in the early days on, and I am hopeful that as it becomes more apparent that peak oil is real and that we either have entered or we are about to enter the phase of global oil production decline, that I hope will concentrate minds and communities into thinking about, now, what should the combined policy be? Because if you're lucky, peak oil will be great for climate. There's plenty of ways in which peak oil could be bad for climate if we just let things run, including, for instance, just burning more coal. For instance, the coal to liquids policy is a really bad idea from the climate, bad idea from the point of view of losing coal miners' lives and mercury emissions and dozens of and wrecking of mountains and so forth. I mean, coal mining, collection, production of coal is a bad idea, full stop. So that's one of the, I'm hoping, and we're working to try and make that one of the outcomes of these rising prices and the slowly dawning understanding of peak oil, because it is only slowly dawning. I'm reasonably sure only a fraction of the populace, both in North America and the world, have any idea about peak oil. So that dawning will help us to make much better climate policy, and that climate understandings will help us to make better peak oil responses.
We are talking with Julian Darley, the founder of the Post Carbon Institute and author of High Noon for Natural Gas, among many other things. He's a prolific writer and speaker found all over. Julian, another interesting tool you bring to the table is more subtle, I think. Most of the mainstream media keeps pushing the idea that some new technology, a car or a battery or something, just around the corner, will save us from declining and dangerous fossil fuels. But you've suggested that social change is not technology, might be a real way to adapt to this new reality. Could you explain that and maybe give us an example?
Yes. I think it's pretty clear that social and cultural changes, including changes in what we believe about the world and how we should behave, are the real key to this. Now, this isn't to say that some technological changes won't be very helpful. We are a creature that can't exist. Most of us can't exist more than 5 minutes, practically, without technology. I mean, almost everybody is wearing clothes at one time or another. People in Canada are using technology all the time for many months of the year to stay warm, as in many other parts of the world. We are absolutely a creature that needs tools. That's how we've got where we are, for better or for worse. So I am not at all dismissing the need for technology and the fact that we've been using it for at least 2 million years and very sophisticated technology for quite a long time. But there is, as far as we can understand, the science points irreducibly in the direction of the fact that without fossil fuels, we just cannot run society the way we've become used to, especially in the industrialized world. So big changes are going to happen. It will be much easier to do these by social and cultural changes and then manage with the science and technology that we can get that we can develop based on a much reduced demand. So this social and cultural change, what's at the bottom of it is the need to reduce demand. If we can greatly reduce demand, there is a very good chance that we could do a good deal about reducing our carbon dioxide outputs and hopefully doing something about climate change. I separate the two up because it's not self-evident now that we can go fast enough to reverse some changes. But by reducing our energy demand dramatically, we'll almost certainly help a lot of other problems that we've caused. You asked for an example.
Well, like sharing, for example.
Well, excellent. Well, maybe we could come right to something that we are engaged in, which is both a mixture of cultural and technology, and that is car sharing. We are pioneering what may well be the first solar car share in the world. Here in Sebastopol, in California, we have 6 all-electric vehicles. 5 of them are trucks because where we are in moderately rural Sonoma County, a lot of people have a demand for small trucks for moving things around, a few yards of soil, all kinds of things that need to get moved around on an occasional basis. And so many people here, as a for instance, it's not true in all parts of the world, but many people here own a sort of dilapidated truck, which just about runs, for these occasional visits to go and get this, that, and the other, which they wouldn't want to put in their first car. I mean, people have a lot of cars here. And so what we're trying to offer is a kind of multi-pronged opportunity to greatly reduce consumption of fossil fuels, in this case gasoline, without losing mobility and utility, possibly even gaining it in that as you develop a car share, you can offer many different kinds of vehicles. So what we have here is a number of electric vehicles which we have built into a car sharing system, not dissimilar to the one in Vancouver and in many other places in North America. The big difference is that they're nearly all electric, which imposes a lot of extra difficult demands on the user because they have to be filled, if you like, with electricity, charged with electricity. So the first thing is, by sharing almost anything, you can reduce the overall demand. It's a very good discipline as well. It's good for building aspects of society and culture. You have to coordinate. You have to work with other people. You have to be, to put it bluntly, a rather good citizen, because if you share something, you take it away, you use it, you must return it to the place where you got it from normally, and you must return it in good condition. If you're either late or it's broken or damaged or dirty in some way, you inconvenience the next person. And so it really teaches you kind of stewardship, husbandry, being a good neighbor, being a good citizen. It brings you back into that necessity And we can extend that out into the rest of society and nature and ecology. So there are some tremendous benefits by sharing. That already has an extremely large effect in reducing the number of vehicle miles traveled, reducing carbon emissions, reducing the amount of gasoline, diesel, or biodiesel consumed. It's approximately 50%. So once you bring in a car sharing system, if you were able to bring it in to a great extent in a town, city, place, you could have an enormous effect overnight. In fact, to think back to that G8 communique, they're calling for a 50% reduction by 2050. If you brought in a car share system, even a fossil fuel-powered car share system, you could get to that 50% tomorrow morning. I mean, it's pretty astonishing. It will do it, isn't it? I think the number is about 47%. But to anybody's, you know, that's good enough. That's 50%. Now, if you bring in the electric part, you can actually go much better because electricity is so much better for powering vehicles. In fact, it's 3 or 4 times more efficient. So you could further reduce that dramatically. Then if you were to power your vehicles with renewable electricity, ultimately renewable electricity is virtually all solar powered one way or another, so direct solar PV or wind, or in some parts of Canada there's lots of renewable electricity available for water, then you've got a situation where you could bring your greenhouse gas emissions and your fossil fuel consumption down to nearly zero. There's embedded energy and implied emissions in the actual devices themselves. Vehicles are not negligible things to produce. They require lots of materials and so forth. Although, let me point out, if you make them much lighter, you can reduce all kinds of impacts in that way, and it makes them much lower in their energy demands as well. And when you start doing electric vehicles, you become sort of an all-out battle to get the weight of the vehicle down. You want to get the resistance down, and you also ideally, and here's a cultural shift, you need to persuade people to drive more slowly, demand less acceleration, and they drive lighter vehicles. That all makes an absolutely huge difference, especially electric vehicles. So this idea of a solar car share is revolutionary in the sense that it could bring emissions and fossil fuel impacts and consumption down to nearly zero very, very fast indeed. But I must say any car share will bring down your these impacts by about 50% more or less as soon as you can get it going at scale. So I think this idea of a solar car share is very exciting. There are a lot of challenges. Even with that, solar photovoltaic is very, very expensive, and you may need up to 100 panels, for instance, to regularly charge a vehicle, an electric vehicle in the car share, a main highway vehicle that will go 60 or 70 miles an hour. That's a lot of panels. I mean, that's probably $200,000 when you finish paying for all the installation and the associated electrical peripheral and so forth. That's a lot of money right now, and it's clearly not economically viable for an individual to do that right now. It certainly won't make up the savings probably in one's lifetime, even if electricity prices keep going up. However, we think it's a powerful pioneering idea, and one of the things that a non-profit institute like Post Carbon Institute is set up to do is to do some research, do things which don't make economic sense now, but make great social, societal, ecological sense.
You know, Julian, I think that some of these things are coming faster than we think. I've seen a model of a Volkswagen built in Germany that gets 235 miles per gallon, and it is ultra light, as you've suggested. They were going to make it in 2012. Now they say they may put out at least a few thousand of them in 2010. And it's fossil fuel, but that's a lot of mileage.
Also, big difference.
Well, listeners, you can get the idea. We've got a huge pool of information and leading ideas here from Julian Darley, I should say. And to find out more, you can go to postcarbon.org or globalpublicmedia.com. Julian, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find all our interviews, programs, and recorded speeches free at our website, ecoshock.org. That's it. Join me next week as we call out for help before the ship goes down.
Let's wind up the troops.
You are about to embark upon the Great Crusade.
Which proves that for pure chilling horror, nothing can beat cold, hard facts.
You'll hear from University of Texas professor and radical Robert Jensen. followed by iconic movement maker Tom Hayden from California. As always, thank you for listening.